grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody. Welcome to episode 315 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, still coming at you live from Austin, Texas, because, you know, Rona. Still not on the road, but plenty of things cooking, plenty of things happening. For all of you out there that have been tuning in these 315 episodes, now I want to say well over a month worth of programming. If you go through and listen to everything, it's absolutely wrong. It's like 31 or 32 days worth of full programming. Stop on by the Dudes and Beer website. That is, of course, where you can find everything. That's where you can find our new app. There's a little link right there at the front. You could also just go to dudesandbeer.com/app, and that'll take you to the download page super easy. Whenever you click on it, you'll see a little Android picture. Click on it, and then on your mobile device, you'll see a download APK pop up. Install it. All kinds of great stuff, man. You can listen to the show live. You get an advanced calendar of guests, which is really available nowhere else. In addition to that, we have the chat function. We have the guest question function where you can chat in questions for upcoming guests, all that kind of great stuff. Stop on by. Check that out. Orchard Dwellers, it is coming your way. Just got to find an ex-coder. We've got the code, all that kind of good stuff. We've got the source. We've just got to find somebody to transmit it into Xcode because, you know, it's an Orchard thing. And in addition to that, we also have some very exciting news. Some good friends that we've worked with here in town and that I've personally used for the last 2 years of my life since the doctor told me to start supplementing my life with CBD for my anxiety. True Hemp Science has come on board with us. They have provided us a fantastic code. Dudes7 is your code. Stop on by truehempscience.com, everybody. That is the website where you can go to get, hands down, and I used to travel the country. I used to, let's just say, go to a lot of recreational facilities across the country where, you know, certain things were legal that are not necessarily legal here in Texas. And because my doctor said, Chris, use CBD, check it out. I made it a point at every shop that I went to check out the local CBD. And I'm here to tell you, man, True Hemp Science, has it nailed. It is, this right here is some of their, stuff that they have available only locally because of the refrigeration necessity of it. You can't even buy it on their website. Number 64. It's one of my favorites, but, you can see right there, like it's got this cinnamon red color because of the cinnamon in it. They use Ayurvedic herbs. Everything is emulsified. All one whole plant extract, not just leaf. So you really do get a lot more of the full curative quality of everything. And man, stop on by. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Dudes7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart. Over $50, any order over $50, use Dudes7. You will save 7% as well as get a free, 50 gram edible. So you'll get a free 50 gram cookie or brownie as well, which are fantastic. Like I said, I've been using their gummies once a day as of late, and they're awesome. For those of you that are toothpick fans out there on the road, you can even get CBD cinnamon flavored toothpicks from them. So, go on by, check that stuff out. Our guest tonight, I'm so excited to have on, Jared Murphy. He is the author of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History. He's also the owner of NotAliens.com, as well as the host of a great show. So we'll be talking about all that. We will be talking about the lost history of mankind, about, you know, things like what we talked with Stephen Myers about, where is it necessary that aliens built the pyramids? No, guaranteed there is a lot of technology that we have had over the millennia that, hey, we've just lost track of. Hey, I would challenge you to give a LP to a 16-year-old and see if they know what it is to begin with or how to work it. Maybe an LP, but probably not an 8-track. Let's put it that way. So we're going to be getting into some of that. It's going to be super fun. While you're online checking out dudesandbeer.com as well as True Hemp Science, make sure to stop on by Podcast Cadet. That is the official sponsor of our show. Let's go ahead and check everything out from them. And then, you know what? We have not actively done the Dudes and Beer News of the Week in a couple weeks. So stop on by the Dudes and Beer Facebook group for all of the news that is great and out there, folks. We have all kinds of conversations. We basically just dump articles there all day long from all kinds of sources. So the new Virgin Galactic spaceship is ready, looking pretty sweet. Teen girls charged with carjacking and murder in the death of the Uber Eats driver in Washington. So that's awesome. You know, it's amazing what kids will live stream on Facebook and other platforms. And whenever you're actively carjacking someone and it leads to their death, you may have an issue. Matt Gaetz is under federal investigation for sexual misconduct. The Biden's dog has had yet another incident of biting. I want to say that makes like 3 or 4 now for him. Mike Turber, our good guest, has put a challenge out there about the UFO UAP footage from To the Stars Academy. He just had a great feed on his channel over on YouTube. Go by and check that out, folks, as well as all kinds of other great news. Dr. Danger out there doing his stunt stuff again. So stop on by. And Fusion Energy, getting ready to shine. That is out of wired.com. So once again, stop on by dudesandbeer.com for all that is the latest and greatest in news and conversations as such. So let's go ahead and check out this message from Podcast Cadet. And when we come back, we will talk to Jared Murphy, author of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Oh, sorry about that. Speaking of issues there, Jared Murphy is our guest tonight. Sorry about the technical issues, folks. There is a little bit of an issue with our Facebook and live feed over there, but things are straightened out. You should have audio, all that kind of stuff now. Our guest, Jared Murphy, tonight is the author of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History, as well as owner of the website, notaliens.com. Welcome to the show, Jared. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. After going through your website, things like that, my copy of the book actually arrives Thursday. Everything in Texas has been still kind of catching up delivery-wise since our snowpocalypse of 4 inches. But yeah. let's start at the beginning, because you weren't necessarily, like, you didn't set out to be a researcher into such things in the world, but it's kind of where you've come to in life, just through your path, people that you've met, and the world that you have immersed yourself in. Let's start at the beginning, and how did you begin down the road of this esoteric knowledge?
Yeah, the very first time, it was really when I was young, I thought I'd be an archaeologist. And then the second thing was to make movies and write books. And then I saw Indiana Jones, and I'm like, no, I'm going to stick with archaeology. And then I was all about the mummies and the golden statues, and I thought that would be great. And then I grew up having a great love of history. My grandfather was a tank commander in World War II. He landed in a tank at D-Day and was in a tank through Belgium and Holland and back to France for Battle of the Bulge and all the way to Berlin. And I was just fascinated with history. And I went from World War II forward and backwards and got into the Dark Ages, and I kept going. And I will out myself as a complete nerd and tell you that I was reading In Search of Schrodinger's Cat and Schrodinger's Cat. Yes. And learning quantum philosophy. And I thought, you know, I just kind of kept up on all of that, where being a self-experimenter and being interested in a number of fields, where I thought one day when I'd finally get back to writing books and making movies, I thought, you know, I had had some experiences in the past where I had I had published some things, but then I'm like, okay, I have an idea for a fictional book, and the fictional book is going to be militaries are going to locate the oldest mummies on Earth, which are at the time the Paracas. This is about 5 years ago. And I'm thinking, okay, they're naturally preserved to 9,000 years. And so the militaries, the premise for my book would be they would reanimate the oldest mummies that they could find in order that they could recall from their memories buried and lost ancient high technology that would be of value. And I would build a fictional book on that. And I had an interest in spintronics and quantum computing and then genetic memory. And I've always had an interest in all of this in science. And I thought, oh, this will be a great fictional story. I'll weave it all together. And then I get 2 or 3 days into studying, and I end up doing research on the Paracas of Peru. And the first thing I get led to is a movie that a lot of people, not the movie, but a lot of people might be familiar with, Brad Pitt in The Lost City of Z. And
yep.
He plays Colonel Percy Fawcett, and he ends up in South. This is not going to ruin the movie for everyone, because you should know going in that Colonel Percy gets lost in the Amazon or gets murdered by tribal whatevers and ends up never returning. And I watch a documentary 2-3 days into my research, and they're on their way to the last village that saw Colonel Percy, who they still talk about at this village. And there's an archaeologist and this TV host that I talk about in the book that you can go look up and watch. And they stop along the Amazon banks of the river there, and they go into an excavated, probably about 12 feet deep, soil. And they say, oh, I just want to stop and look at this before we go to this last place Colonel Percy Fawcett's been seen. And it's called Terra Preta. It's an engineered soil. It's very mysterious. Over 100 years of scientific research of soil scientists have looked at this. They don't know how to make it. It's the richest growing soil on Earth. And in the future, as I looked into it, it turned out that it had piezoelectric properties. It had a number of other capabilities that literally made no sense. And they said in follow-up, as I get 3 days into research, they say, oh yeah, it's at least twice the size of Great Britain here in the Brazil. And Terra Preta also shows up in North Africa and Australia. And I'm like, hold on here. There's an ancient engineered soil all over the Earth, and there's not just Terra Preta, there's other ones. And for 3.5 years, I start with this one pillar and start looking and seeing that there is ancient engineered soil in places that should be nomadic, and they are not nomadic. They should not be, like, Göbekli Tepe should be where Göbekli Tepe is. And instead, we have engineered soil all over the Earth 3.5 years later. And Olaf Phillips, you know, Anomalies Press, my book, you know, we spend 6 months editing and adding things. And before you know it, it looks to me, and this isn't ruining the book for anyone, but that a lot of the UFOs that aren't accounted for as military, in reality, Is it likely that they're interdimensional space traveling aliens, or is it likely based on all the evidences we can table from engineered soil with piezoelectric and self-maintaining and replicating capabilities, which we can get into, to genetic and frequency and energy things that seem to appear within these polygonal, like the Great Pyramid and these other polygonal constructions around the world? Does it appear that a very advanced, ancient, lost human society was here, fell apart, likely survived in some capacity, and what we mistake as not terrestrial humans are really just genetically bod-modified, zero-point-turning, tic-tac-flying humans, in a nutshell?
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's kind of the discussion, like I said earlier, that we had with our guest, Stephen Meyer, about from the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, is that all too often we are ready to jump to the science fiction extreme.
Yeah,
let's just say. And I mean, to no fault, you sound like you're right up around my age. I am 45 years old. Maybe you're younger than me. But
maybe I'm not. But you don't take that back. Take that back.
Okay.
No, I'm perfectly fine. But I'm comfortable in my 40 somethings.
Yeah, same here. And I mean, you know, it really is the fact that we were really that first generation for this to be an ingrained part of our culture already. Yes. It's not like it was our parents, you know, who grew up going to drive-ins and then, you know, grew up seeing alien movies come about, Jetsons, things like that. You know, I even saw a meme picture today that was talking about how the Jetsons was so accurate. It was like, look, you know, virtual doctor visits, you know, teleconferencing, working from home. It was all kinds of stuff. Yeah. But that was the norm that we grew up with. So for us growing up with TV shows like V, things like that, where we were introduced to the concept of aliens living amongst us. Perhaps some of these things aren't so strange, but does it necessitate the fact when it comes to ancient technology, ancient cultures, that it has to come from somewhere else? I don't necessarily think so. Don't get me wrong. I am a big believer. Heart and soul, Jared, believer. But I'm also like, hey, I'd like to see a little bit of science. That'd be cool.
So in 3.5 years, what really is crazy is to say, and I try to explain it to people too about our generation and about the differences of, you know, Eric von Daniken's groundbreaking work and for people to shift this paradigm that it just really wasn't in the, there's a reason the Christian faith stayed in Latin for as long as it did. You know, you can't question anything. It sounds mysterious and interesting. And then, but here we are with, if you table just the facts we know, not, that's coincidental. Oh, that's a mystery. Oh, that's mysterious. No. It's not mysterious. It's a fact. There is, and again, having 20 years in historical remodeling, when I look at a construction, I see it very differently than a lot of people. But anyone who's does any architectural work, physical building, you don't go to Machu Picchu or Ollantaytambo or Sacsayhuaman or anywhere in Egypt or anywhere in Angkor Wat, and you go all over the world and you see the exact, even Rapa Nui or Easter Island has polygonal masonry. Forget the giant Easter Island heads / full-bodied statues. There is polygonal construction and giant and small stone spheres all over the earth. And when we look at this, no one builds a building and then finishes it with river rock. Like you build 100 to 800 to 1,000 to 1,200 to 3,000 ton stone polygonal walls around the world. And then, you know, you get bored. So you finish it with some rock on the ground and some lean-to wood with some guys at the Natural History Museum in loincloths banging rocks together. And you're like, that did not happen. That's just not how they built that construction. There were definitely, clearly, a rebuild period or a readaptation period. Yep. It is clear that this is a different. So then if you strip away dynastic Egyptians, dynastic Aztecs, dynastic peoples like the Mayans, the Olmecs, the Toltecs, stuff like that. You get rid of all of them. And then you just, and I don't mean get rid of them. You just look at the fact that they adapted something that was much older. And how do we know this? What are the facts? Like, right to your point from the beginning, I come across Michael Cremo's really foundational work, Forbidden Archaeology. I think it's a, you know, he went from spending 9 months to 10 years writing this book. And all it does is there was a period of, well, I was always confused when I was in college. Did you have an art history class?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Why was history art history and not just history? Why is, like, I thought the mummy in the museum at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, well, wait, is it art or is it history?
Yeah.
Why is it in the art? I was always confused, right? And here what we have is the origins of archaeology started with Victorian people wanting statues on their mantles. That's how it started. And then nobody took it seriously. Well, the second they start taking it seriously, you have Michael Cremo reviewing not new, but paleoanthropological finds starting in the 1800s that show eolus, neolus, that show anatomically correct human being bones being found in places like the Red Crag in the Mediterranean and in layers of the earth at 2 million, 5 million, 20 million. Table Mountain is his favorite space. And there's a couple of Table Mountains in America, but this is the Gold Rush Table Mountain in California, 60 million years old. You have boot prints and stitch prints that even the Rockefeller Foundation looked at that was 150 million. And so the first thing we can table before we go, oh, that's a mystery, and say, well, you know, sedimentary objects can sometimes freeze quickly. So we don't know how old that boot print really is. It may not be 150 million. Okay, well, let's just take paleoanthropological findings of humans in layers of earth that do not go and coincide with the Victorian era science of the theory. Again, it's a theory in quotes. It's not indoctrinated theory is not a fact. It's just a theory. But we look at everything through these lenses and then, oh, and you and I are Westerners. So, you know, forget about those silly people in the East, you know, and their funny little, you know, their Ganeshas and their dancing Ganeshas.
Their multi-thousand year oral history that hadn't really changed. That is like the core of their religious belief.
Yeah, you know, don't discount over half the human population on Earth's belief in a religion that has nothing to do with Christianity and is only, oh, it accounts for millions of years of history. Yeah. Literally, they have an epic. It's not, well, some people would argue that the oldest religious items are, of course, from Sumer or Sumeria. And Sumer has the epics of Gilgamesh, which get translated into the Bible. Well, they started Sumerian, and there's cuneiform A and B. We have not translated B. We don't know what B says. And the Sumerian we have, the Sumer cuneiform A that we have translated is actually from a Syrian king, and it's from his library that we found. Like, and by the way, there are millions of tablets. Not only cuneiform B has not been translated, but we don't have you can actually get onto the database that has the cuneiform, and you can learn it. You can start winging it and start trying to help translate literally millions of documents that have just not, they haven't gotten to it. You'd think, you know, they would put down the pot they put back together at the entry to Disney World and start excavating Disney World and maybe start working on the language. But that, you know, there's a lot of distraction and misinformation, and there's some academic hubris. There's a lot of reasons not to. But what we have is these Hindu Vedas and this history that is accounting for what may be an eyewitness account of a. Right now we have 150 tribes on Earth, give or take, that they live in jungles, they live in deserts, they live in Arctic regions, and they live the ways that we did 50,000 years ago. And so simultaneously, if we find, well, we found these rock banging eoliths and neolith tools, and so these, we were primitive. It's like, is it just like today? You can go buy a very fancy phone and a cool Jeep. You can also find primitive people that don't use any of it today.
Yeah.
And they, if in 10,000 years, all of our metal and stuff is going to be readapted for something or a pointy stick. And then you're still going to find the eelless and eelless. Right.
It won't even be here. Like, there are Discovery Channel shows. I think it's called The End of Man.
Yeah.
And it's like two or three seasons long, but it's crazy, dude, where you go see like major cities like Detroit and then they start aging it by like 100 years where there is no repair. Yeah. Granted, and that's pretty close to Detroit anyway. It literally looks like World War Z wasteland. Like there is nothing there because our concrete is not made to last. Our steel is not made to last without maintenance, you know?
Yeah. If we have millions of years of paleo, so we have actual records of humans and layers of Earth that discount the theory of evolution as we state it currently, that, you know, that we modern anatomically correct humans only really appeared in the last, 2 million years of evolution from being potentially monkeys and whatever. But then we have these paleoanthropological finds of anatomically correct humans that predate those numbers. And we have, that means, a number of things then don't add up for large polygonal constructions that look more like they predate dynastic periods. Well, we can dynastically say, just to wing it right now, to make it quick, is, the Egyptians were around at least 6,000 BC, but the oldest Egyptians that spoke to the Greek Solon, the one that we get really the story of Atlantis from, when he was there, there's a king's list even in Egypt, and that dates back about, coincidentally, 36,000 years.
Yep.
And one of the things I came across, which was super fascinating, off the west coast of Cuba, they were looking for Spanish galleons and gold. Castro had actually approved about 15 years ago a team to go look for sunken treasure vessels. So they find an anomaly and they take a picture. It's all over the internet. And in future, for those conspiracy people, you can look into the fact that allegedly National Geographic bought the rights to the story and they've done nothing with it. But there is a city and it's been photographed and it has pyramids. It has polygonal walls and it's 2,300 feet deep. And the last time that city would have been above ground would have been at a minimum around 55-ish, 50, somewhere in there, 1,000 years ago at a minimum.
Yeah.
And then we have massive land masses like, and I'm going to equate that city, which also lines up with a mainstream theory of humans, they say, and Denisovan and Neanderthal and a mystery, in quotes, mystery, 14% of a species of humans that we don't have an eye on, not to mention the fact that we didn't even know we had a double helix or quad helix. I mean, there's actually a quad helix, but we didn't know anything about all the DNA mapping that we're even familiar with has been in the last 26 years. And it was a woman, not men, that actually came up with that DNA thing. But that's a different story and for later. And what we have is a super volcano having a super catastrophe, which we estimate at about 75,000 years ago. So a lot of people right now, in longer dialogues and conversations, people like to jump to, something really happened or multiple things happened during what's called the Younger Dryas. So somewhere between 11 and 13,000 years ago, we think, it all went to crap. Well, we're assuming that these elongated skulled people that I started talking about, the Paracas, which are not pressed, their heads are not pressed, they're made.
Yeah.
They are just born this way. So for all those people who are 6 degrees of separated, dudes, everyone out there that knows someone that says they work at a prestigious university and no one has genetically mapped the Paracas or any, by the way, all over the earth, elongated skulled humans that were naturally born this way. I learned about some of the details about their anomalies physically with some work Brian Forster's done. I showed it. He said he showed it to doctors. Well, shit, I showed it to a couple doctors. I showed it to a couple surgical nurses. And I said, what do you think of these skulls? And they went, the suture lines, the neck, everything that Brian Forster was pointing out in his books, the doctors and nurses I showed it to, they were like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And yet we don't have a single academic institution that's had the nuts to pick up that what's literally in their face. There are bones all over Peru, literally laying out, and not just bones, man. There's actual genetic tissue
almost entire graveyards that have been exposed from. And granted, you know, the looters leave the bones. The bones are worth nothing to them. They're looking for pottery. Exactly. They're looking for gold, beadwork, things like that. So they leave the bones. But the odd thing is, like, the scientific find is the bones, man. That is worth untold knowledge to mankind. And it's interesting that you bring that up because, whenever there are no sagittal sutures on the Paracas skulls, like they're normally 4 points of connection to a human skull and these only have 3. It's absolutely phenomenal to bizarre. Know, like you said, that these bones are just laying out exposed and yet still science, like you said, it is their own hubris. And we talk about it frequently on this show, the quote religion of science.
I like Carl Lehrberger's thing. He calls it the archaeopriests.
Yeah. Straight up, man. It is the temple, the priests of the Temple of Syrinx. Like, we will control what you think. Like, that's not a guitar. You don't know what you're talking about. That will do no good for humanity. It's horrifying, but it's so absolutely true.
We deserve to know.
And not only do we deserve to know, I'm pretty sure that we're funding to know.
Yeah, no kidding, right? You know, so
like we're funding the people to actively, academically lie to us.
That is so well put. That's just so well put.
It blows my mind, but it's absolutely true.
So here's something for someone, and this has to do with something I'm going to be doing here. Hopefully it is a bit longer plan, but one of the things as a construction guy and as a builder, something that I'm very familiar with is foundations and construction and heavy weights. And so there's a couple things. I mentioned the word polygonal. So these are these blocks that people, the first thing everybody says, you know, is you can't fit a piece of paper between them, and they're super good joints, and they're usually brought from hundreds of miles away, and they're the hardest stones on earth. And it's always a combination of quartz, limestone, basalts, and there's a piezoelectric property to it. Yusuf Aiwan of Egypt does a video testing that theory. You can see that's on Ben from Uncharted X. That's one of his videos, and it's a great example of the piezoelectric quality. So we have this engineered soil, but these polygonal constructions, everyone talks about them. Like, I named off Ollantay Tambo and Sacsayhuaman and Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and Cusco, there's Egypt, there's polygonal construction, Temple of Delphi, Greeks, all over Greece, Malta, Sardinia. It's all over the world, this construction, Angkor Wat, Easter Island. And then again, remember everyone, it's not above ground, it's underwater. There are cities, not just off the coast of Cuba, but Doggerland used to connect Ireland and Scotland all the way to France. And Doggerland, much of it was above water even 4,000 years ago. That's well within dynastic periods. And the thing that I'm getting to is that something no one's one, soil's not sexy. I think it is, but soil's not sexy, and neither is not finding the Indiana Jones golden statue with the mummies coming out with the snakes and stuff. So what no one's done, and I don't like to point out that I'm the first one to point it out. However, construction of foundations of polygonal walls that are millions of tons of stone that after all these years not only work together in earthquakes, something I had theorized, and right before publishing in 2019, some scientists corroborated my theory, not because they knew of my work. They just independently said, hey, we noticed that these, in quotes, Greco-Roman amphitheaters and these assorted other constructions appear to have seismic metastructures within their foundations. It appears that the pylons from their geo surveys showed a very earthquake muting capability, even from the pillars within the foundations. And they cited that they couldn't help but notice, but the type of seismic metamaterials are anything from nanostructures, like crystals as small as a bead of sand, to as large as a stone sphere, that can act as a wave resonator to mute, amplify, or mute a wave, a frequency, for instance, an earthquake. So one of the things that I'm looking into right away is, we look at the technology of these stones and go out of, like, we have no idea how they built them. And that's the first thing that you should table for anyone who's either not just a stonemason or a stoneworker or a granite countertop maker, but the very act of quarrying the size of the stones and the way they're shaped and the types matter to the equipment, that not only are they building them in a way that is muting an earthquake in that exact area to wherever that theoretical tectonic plate is in the ground, they're creating a building that also has piezoelectric properties, but also the seismic metamaterials. This is the thing that no one's ever talked about, and this is a thing that I'm
actually
don't point it out.
Because
material.
Well, and a prime example is I'm bringing up on screen right now images of ancient Greek temples. And one of the things that the Greeks did, which was, of course, adopted by Romans, they borrowed a lot from their architecture, but was the interlocking column. And it was because, like, yeah, dude, they live on a chain of islands. They learned a little bit about stuff whenever Minos exploded, you know? like, they lost a pretty good whole society when Minos went down. So, yeah, they actively made their foundations floating. It was absolutely wild. And the columns were made with, like, interlocking parts, where you can see the segmentation here, but it was like a peg of marble that fit into a socket of marble on the bottom. So that whenever an earthquake happened, they could jostle independently and it didn't cause a crack up the whole column. Brilliant technology for literally thousands of years ago, and an amazing concept that we even use today whenever you're talking about places like California. Japan, I know, was a huge progenitor in earthquake-proof buildings where they sit on top of shock absorbers, things like that.
Yep, and they're right down to sifting the soil next to the building, creating holes. And what we don't account for in these buildings, because it's not looking for jewelry and gold and mummies, is that the foundation, but the pre-compaction of under the polygonal blocks is something no one's taken a core sample. What if Jennifer Deo, a friend of mine, an archaeologist, she's like, Jared, it's mind-blowing because, Jared, you're the first person I've ever heard to talk about this. And what if one of the layers is a crushed seashell from 1,000 miles away? What if, you know, when we just for everyone listening, if you build a house today, and in Minnesota, you know, we have basements, but not everybody has a basement. But when you even lay a slab, a contractor is supposed to pre-compact the soil, whether it's clay or sand or dirt or whatever you got in your area. But if you have a frost footing, you have to go down and then you pre-compact the soil that you're going to stick. So you dig a hole, you go down 4 feet, and you pre-compact the soil that you then put class five on, which is like basically your average gravel road. Then you pre-compact it. Then you put sand in and you pre-compact it. But at the end of the day, then you pour a wall 4 to 8 feet tall. But we're talking about these millions of tons polygonal blocks sitting on what? And also there's a rule right now for all of you out there, 90% your pre-compacted soil that you put your foundation on, whether it's a floating slab, because you guys are, shout out to Florida, and you have sand, but if you have a floating foundation, it's still supposed to be pre-compacted to 90%. Yeah. And first off, everybody can make a big fat zero, because most of the time, no one pre-compacts their walls to 90%. And that's why you have barely a 100 or 200 year old home. And it's like a fun house with like marbles.
Yeah, it's a wacky shack.
Right, but you have, even if you accounted for dynastic times, no one's ever stopped to pull a core sample of imagine if you're like, well, they appear to have built the polygonal wall on another rock wall. Well, what if it's pre-compacted to 100%? What if it's a geopolymer? What if it is 90%, but it's like 40 layers deep? What if it's 40 feet, not the 2 feet that we weekly do and frequently don't pre-compact? Yeah. Well, no one's done that work. So not only have I written, but I'm also out prepping for field studies, and we're trying to answer these questions, because as sexy as soil wasn't, man, I am all about just the sexy foundation is something we have no eyes on. What if it's like 60 different kinds of crushed rock and components that made that polygonal wall sit straight still. Yeah. Not just the blocks, but we use pylons, but they were using pylon soil, piezoelectrically enabled engineered soil to not just grow food, but to, you know, we have a lot going on here.
And just for our audience out there, like I myself, I modify pedals, build circuits, all kinds of fun things. I know what piezoelectric is. Let's explain that for our audience out there that may not know what that term means, because it literally does come from like right here, like quartz crystal, and the properties of crystals to be able to, under compaction, create a current.
Yeah. And so one of the mysteries on these polygonal blocks is they frequently are using a mix of quartz, basalts, and limestones. And like earlier I mentioned, and I wish I had the link for it, I should have thought of it, but there are experiments that go on with what kind of currents can travel through stone. Mm. And why are they using these high quartz computer-like polygonal blocks? You know, on one hand, so let's just say, based on paleoanthropological evidence, we've been here millions of years, and let's just say a very advanced, look at what we've done in 100, but imagine a society a million years ago, or in the Hindu Vedas, if we're taking them seriously, because we're not just all Western biased, but a highly advanced group of humans, they can control only so much. I mean, and then sometimes you just get godsmacked by a giant meteor. And so how do you manage a water rise of even 30 feet? Well, build with giant polygonal blocks, you know, handle large water. But if you're using earth circuits like the Nazca lines, and there's acid levels like in a battery, there are conditions in which electrical current flows and travels. So if we have a soil that even at the lowest levels, just like if you guys are at home and you rub your feet across a carpet and you get static electricity, a lot of people in the computer world know that, you know, the reason they ground themselves before they work on your computer is that when you go and rub your feet in the socks across the floor and you shock your brother and your sister or whoever for funsies, that you don't even actually register at the human contact level. You don't register static electricity till it's above 10,000 volts. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah. And if you have, this brings up keystone cuts, which are also all over the world, which is why when you have this large polygonal block that are multiple, like 15, 20, 30 sided, flat and perfectly fit together on every side, perfectly like a melted marshmallow. Yeah. Why is it you would need metal to connect between the stones? Things we don't ask. Well, we think, oh, you know, it's to help them if they were moving and flexing with an earthquake. And okay, they're not really moving. And if they are, it's the whole building. And we make an assumption that the material sciences stop at stone. So side note, rabbit hole for everyone is, why do you assume that it's just stone they were good at cutting and moving, when the very instruments that would be needed to do that would also mean that there are material sciences for glass and plastic and finished materials and wood, and what they could do with 60-foot diameter redwoods would be as epic as what they do with the stone. But in order for electrical current to travel between living things and or through the ground, through a building that has qualities of exactly what you find in your computer, you have your digital board and now just plug, which you can look at in my book is the example of the idea of like Teotihuacan in Mexico is a good example of it. Looks like a basic circuit. And then we have these other elements with the metal connecting points between stones. What is it that they're doing with these buildings? One, they've been around hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of years, and they need to build in a way that is going to withstand large incidents. Two, might be, you know, scalar wave induced, but the piezoelectric quality is that the building itself can be connected, where barefoot runners and people already know that, and not just the Paracas, and this ties us in talking about the electrical switching going on in the buildings themselves, that these buildings are conducive to communications with what we already scratch our heads at within our our pineal gland, within our the Carilion photography and vibrational, not woo-woo, but actual science of homeopathic medicine falls under vibrational medicine.
Yeah.
And there are so many aspects and pieces of the human condition. Like I talk about superhumans. I follow Wim Hof. All of this connects to a human being that could stand in a building, and the building itself can be connected to the soil around it, which seems to be an obvious point. But if it had electrical current capabilities of being able to transmit a current that doesn't electrocute everyone standing on it, but can connect to a building that is built very much like a giant motherboard circuit, a simple circuit, like Teotihuacan.
And here's just another thought. It just dawned on me a second ago, especially whenever you're talking about piezoelectric soil and compacting things to 100%, that would mean that if that soil was piezoelectric and it was compacted to 100%, that it would constantly be outputting.
Right.
Especially when you're talking about things like bone, stuff like that, like the whole concept of braces. In the way that braces work, not many people understand this, but it is actually the piezoelectric quality of our saliva. And the fact that they put thicker wire on one side of your mouth than the other, so that the minor voltage conductivity of your saliva causes the bone to grow more on that side than the other. So
I learned something today.
That may actively be something about why people like the Paracas Indians, stuff like that, people that were around these facilities and worshipped in these facilities regularly, that perhaps they were experiencing a different type of bone growth.
That's interesting. And also, I think that we have slivers of truths in all the post-flood, whether it be legends or faiths. The reality is that we label everyone. It drove me nuts even when I was doing art history. This was a temple. This is a temple. They were worshiping here. That statue's a goddess. Mm. And I'm like, these are – like they had so much time in between killing deer to worship. It's an incredible society. They just all the time in a church. They never built anything unless it was a church. Everything's a goddess. You know, it wasn't an eighth grade dude making a big boob statue. It was a goddess. You sure it wasn't an eighth grade kid? Just like dad's the potter in town. And it's like, I made another booby statue.
Yeah.
You know, why isn't it that guy? Yeah. You know, some kid. And then it's like, oh, this is an adorn. This is a very important fertility goddess. No, pretty sure it was an eighth grade kid. You know, just being stupid in shop class. And so we have a pinhole view. You know, if you
a very myopic view when it comes to things, because we so entirely judge it by modern means. So entirely.
Even
the situation that recently happened here in Texas. With the loss of electricity, things like that. Most people have no idea what it takes to power or power on or repower up a grid. They just know when they switch the light, it turns on. And if it doesn't, you get a new bulb. And if not, why is my power not work?
There's always an answer with a virgin and a volcano.
At the very least, a stopgap solution.
Right. Well, we tried. Maybe we need a different virgin.
I don't know. You're sure she was a virgin?
Yeah. Was it a blood moon? Did you do during the blood moon? Did you?
Well,
yeah.
With that in mind, especially talking about the religion of science, talking about I wouldn't necessarily say. It's hard not to say purposeful obfuscation. However, without saying that, with the definite ignoring of evidence that is there, or at least quandaries that should be investigated and hypotheses that should be highly looked at, to say the least. What kind of connection do you see with modern society whenever you look at these past societies? What kind of do you see any kind of wash, rinse, repeat going on in that realm?
Yeah, I think that the best way I describe us currently on the surface of, I think there was a global society that crashed either naturally or through war or both. And the survivors, again, our modern scientists, Denisova and Neanderthal, Mystery 14%, a bunch of people all bred around 50,000 plus years ago. Mm. And I think that represents the beginning of what I would call what was once an engineered terraformed planet, where those slivers of truths and do we used to talk to animals? Did we used to live indefinitely or for thousands or, you know, at least as old as Methuselah to as old as an Anunnaki god or a Sumerian king's list,
yeah,
to like tens of thousands of years? You know, we are in basically safe mode, like a computer that has basic BIOS function. And so you can get into the computer, you can probably get a new operating system loaded on it, but you know, it's slightly broken. We have weird abilities like synesthesias that, you know, allow all five senses to connect, and not just internally, but between other people, and wide proof, yeah, of collective human consciousness. And without being able to go down all those rabbit holes, what we have are people making decisions with 10 to 15% consciousness. And that is far below a fully woke human race would be doing much higher level thinking. So when you say rinse, wash, repeat, we are living currently, as that whole thing you pointed out earlier, in a world of idiocracy.
Oh, absolutely.
And, yeah, and I don't think it's
the thirst mutilator.
Oh my gosh. It's got electrolytes. It's got what the body craves.
Yeah. It's what plants crave.
It's absolutely what plants crave. It's just, it's got electrolytes. And that's how we have literally in this, I will only say, dystopian sci-fi novel that we're living. Watch currently how easily you can revert to the Middle Ages without even losing your electrical grid.
Oh,
we got people,
God,
believing in electrolytes.
Brother, I say it on this show all the time. Do not forget, people, according to all science, humanity as we know it's been around for, what, 3,500, maybe 5,000 years, if you go by the Jewish calendar, you know. When you're looking at that, we've been here for just a smattering of time. And in that time, only 500 years ago did we collectively decide that the world was not flat.
I know.
Before that,
burning people.
For the last 4,500 years, my man, we were like excommunicating people. We were sending people out of the village if you said that the earth was round. That was like witchery.
Yeah.
You know, like, heck, I'm a redhead, yeah, man. You realize why there are so few of us? We were like burned at the stake.
No, that makes sense. You guys, you're a ginger. If that's the case, you know, no soul.
It's not that we don't have no soul. It's that we have one for every freckle.
Oh, that is just evil. In which case, you know, I feel like it's a waste of wood. Don't burn you, you know? It's just,
that's right.
Yep, that's it, gingers.
It really is this archaic mentality, and it's absolutely wild to know that, like I said, wash, rinse, repeat, and it's kind of horrifying to know that. Yeah, the same way that, quote, the prophets of old were running around and going, hey, you know, if you don't stop doing this horrible thing might happen. Wow, you're a crazy person. and then the horrible thing happens. And here we are, and don't get me wrong, I was no fan of our former president, no fan of our current president. but whenever you hear about people like witches from across the country getting together as a coven and casting a spell against somebody, it's like, wait a minute, isn't that like totally against what you believe? And then you wonder why the world has gone horribly awry.
it's stunning to me that we have all these institutions of alleged higher learning and institutions where we say, you know, if you got a problem with your, you know, with your body or something, you know, this is, these are the places to go. And we have well established science. It is not a new thing. And then we jump into the dark ages and in witchcraftery and say, well, you know, do this and you'll be fine. And it's like, is anyone at all discerning wisdom from belief and the difference between the two?
Yes.
And nope, not at all. Would you like two things that don't work?
Yeah.
Are you, is this, and I have these dialogues with people privately. And of course, you know, that's why I have notaliens.com for the member area, but also Rockfin, where it's like, okay, can I say this and not get banned? You know?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. You can give it a shot, brother. And if anything, you got my airwaves to give it a shot on. My joy is giving people the news that their episode has been banned.
I think we've coded it just fine, but it's like two wrongs do not make a right.
No.
Have you read everything you needed to know you learned in kindergarten? That was a great book. The Emperor's New Clothes.
Tell people all the time. I taught ages 4 to 40. In my life, and technically the only difference is by 40 you should know not to pull people's hair,
right?
Like, I have been asked the most stupid questions by a 40-year-old and the most deep confounding questions by a 4-year-old. We are no different. The only difference is how we view our selfishness in the world, and if we do something good and altruistic with it, that's it.
Yeah. And if everyone out there listening hasn't picked up what you're saying, it's sometimes you want to sit down and have a beer with a 4-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
See?
I sit down and have a beer with mine. He's kind of jealous with the fact that he can't have it. But we have great conversations.
Right. Yeah. And you know, this is also my argument, by the way, where I think we should give no breaks to older drivers. None. They should be the fastest, most efficient Indy 500 horn honking, pissed off, aggressive Indy 500 driver.
Left-hand turns at 120, dude.
Oh, absolute. We're talking Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. If you can't be the best driver, and by the way, the most courteous, efficient. Like, if you have an option to be in the middle lane and allow people to turn right and left, you get a sticker.
Wait a minute. Are you like me and purposefully don't hover in the right-hand lane so that you can complain about people that hover in the right-hand lane? Because, I gladly psychologically admit that that is why I do not hover in the right-hand lane, is because otherwise I cannot reserve the right to complain.
Well, it's just, before you walk out your door, you should recite something. You are not the only one on the road. Everyone has somewhere to be. Everyone has somewhere to be in a mall. If you stop walking and you know there's hundreds of people behind you,
step to the side.
To walk around you.
Step to the side.
Step aside and then stop. Yeah. But don't go out and assume you're the only person on the road. In fact, develop a herd mentality and try to work efficiently together, because guess what? No matter how many people you pass or inefficiently cut off or inefficiently drive around, none of them will be in the spot where you're going to be when you get to where you need to be. None of them. And stop slowing down at accidents. What the hell? Just
something horrible happened. Move on.
It's got electrolytes. It's got what my eyes crave.
Well, and you know, I know that we've kept you right in an hour right now. If you have a few more minutes, let's chat real quick, because the concept of piezoelectricity is like so entirely near and dear to my heart. And like I said, whenever you started talking about the piezoelectric quality of some soils and the fact that this piezoelectric soil exists across the earth, I want to crack that nut a little bit more.
Oh, because it's
not sexy for normal people, but for people who listen to this show, it's sexy as hell, Jared.
Right.
But, like, straight up, that those are the nerds that listen to this show, because it's something phenomenal to think about. The fact that a soil in and of itself can create energy. And granted, whenever you're talking about piezoelectric, don't forget that also means that much like a piezoelectric buzzer, when hooked up in reverse, can act as a microphone and pick up signals. It can send signals too.
Oh, you're getting somewhere for me, which is great because we're going to bring the Nazca lines in on this, which Eric Von Daniken.
And it's interesting because you referred to them earlier as living circuits, as Earth circuits. And I really want to let's move from the piezoelectric soil and its presence across the Earth, because granted, that's one that I think would be, I do not discount the capabilities of our ancient peoples. I do not. Good Lord, there is cocaine found in, or coca leaves rather, found in mummies in Egypt. They only grow in one place. You cannot grow coca outside of the Andes and outside of South America. It just does not work.
No, they had the international patent for it back then, yo.
So exactly. they were the first Pfizer.
they were.
Is Peruvian for Pfizer.
Granddad just sneefing a whole line going, tell Cleopatra she ain't getting none of her normal monthly shipment.
she ain't getting no regs now.
See, our birthday party goes over now.
That's it. To say that they had no contact, I think is utterly naive. Utterly naive to say in any context. I mean, even whenever you look at some of the artifacts found on the East Coast of America, even whenever you look at things like America's Brazil, Stonehenge, you know?
Absolutely. America's Stonehenge. There's 800 sites like America's Stonehenge. Yeah. I'll be there May 1st in person. And
nice.
I'll be giving a live lecture. You can actually meet me and come to my live lecture on May 1st, Saturday, and or hear it virtually. You can get a ticket on Not Aliens. But there's also Anfora Bay in Brazil. It's literally Anfora Bay because it's filled with Roman galleon.
Anforas.
Jars,
vases. So there's,
and then we have then I'm assuming you've talked to your audience about the P. Reese Reese map.
Yes.
The maps of the Sea King. So what are we doing with accurate here's two parts. One is the coast of Antarctica with no ice on it, which was at least 8,000 years ago, 6,000 at a minimum. But then you have accurate projections of longitude.
Which did not exist.
It
did not exist until the coming of the actual compass and the compass rose and all that.
Yeah, the 75 years until they came up with projections that could match what was on that map. And mind you, some people don't know about the P. Reese Reese map. Admiral Reese, that map was just not – that was actually a world map, and that was a ripped-off section of a world map. And then you have
accurate depiction of North America.
Yeah, and way beyond a scale. And they write on the map, well, this is a copy of a copy of a bunch of copies of a bunch of stuff. We're just doing an update, basically, in a nutshell.
Yeah, there are footnotes.
And so, right, and then back to Sumer, again, curious. We have the Babylonian Plimpton tablet, which is showing the Pythagorean things that were credited to Pythagoras almost about 1,000 years before, and in the form of what is basically a teacher's tablet, which clearly shows that they have been around it a long time. And then the coincidences of pi being used in ziggurats and pi being used in the Great Pyramid. And what do we know about pi? Its first and foremost nerd out value is as an Egan value, sweet cheeks out there. It's all about the frequency, Kenneth. Egan values.
Amen. And even to know that the only way that the Great Pyramid of Giza could have been affixed atop the center of mass of the Earth would right. have been to know the Pythagorean theorem.
Right.
You got to know it.
Yeah.
It's essential yeah. because inside of that sphere is a triangle.
It is such a squirm worthy. Now we're all on the vertical of this, So you have Eric, I got to meet Eric Von Daniken a couple of years ago.
Man.
And we got to talk for a while. Yeah. It was really great. I got to talk to him for a while. He was very generous with his time. And he said, Jared, I got to do, because you know, I'm an honorary citizen of NASCA. I got to do, a test of the electromagnetic, the currents in the Nazca lines.
Wow.
It's real. It's there. Not the monkey spider stuff. That's all graffiti from later dynastic cultures. It's all interesting. That's great. It's a giant monkey. Who cares? I care about, it's like graffiti on super high technology. And so you have these earth circuits like the Nazca lines. There's Bolivian Nazca lines. There's literally just as many lines. And he said, you know, we tested it. There's definitely arsenic. There's definitely the same material science within the ground that shows that the ground was treated, and it seems to be intentional. And so if we are doing a giant earth, and right now there's I've read Born to Run by Christopher McDougall, and they talk about the science of, just as a reference, great book, fun book for people who like to read. But you have the grounding effect everyone knows in mainstream science of just the electron exchange. Oh, yeah, you get barefoot or you get back to the earth. You actually have a download. But as you pointed out earlier, you can have an upload. And
absolutely.
If you are. And so now if you have
same carrier frequency.
Here we go. So here we back to Egan values, and we have too much. When you start tabling in a room, it's like, okay, let's just work out how advanced some prior unknown human society was. And if you table the, not just the math values of, also the locations of these constructions, and mind you, again, metal, all other materials that are man-made would be repurposed or redone.
Huge uranium deposits under Nazca.
As
far as rare earth metals, things like that, lithium, all kinds of stuff.
And we think of it as, well, yeah, you pull those things out and you use it in a little pocket device. Well, these people were using it on a global scale.
Yeah.
I've
got one even up right now that is straight up the I'm trying to remember. Good God, Benjamin Lone Tree would kill me. The Vlotsky, the Vlotsky spirals, you know, that basically helped generate like rare earth energy, that helped generate 8 hertz, stuff like that, you know, where you've got the concentric spiral. And exact same thing in the Nazca lines. Whenever you start looking at the Nazca lines, like the circle of the sun, stuff like that, that are, I mean, and of course, you know, the traditional Nazca lines of the tarantula and all that kind of stuff are wicked cool. The monkey, the spaceman.
Yeah, they're neat.
All
they're
amazing.
Neat.
But man, when you start looking at the geometry of things like the circle of the sun and start seeing straight up mandalas in the desert, like, and even the kinship of the way a mandala looks to the way that CERN, you know, like the Large Hadron Collider, things like that. Like,
yeah, and also the mandala that matches Ohm.
Yes.
They had Ohm. And how did they know that? And it's like, well, there was just enough monks and they chanted and someone saw something vibrating and they sorted it out. One of the things I was fascinated about as a kid was, and cymatics. So,
cymatics is my jam.
Oh, man. As a kid, I was fascinated. One of the things that I was curious about was the complexity of the patterns of Corinthian columns to textiles in clothing. Why mandalas no different? What if, as a technology degrades, they knew the pattern of the circuitry or they knew the pattern of the frequency and they embroidered it and it became a more of a, it ultimately became an artistic fashion, but that was not the intent or the original purpose of the Om Mandala. You know, it wasn't supposed to be ethereal. Esoteric.
I'm going to say it on here mainly as a means of copyright. We're gonna consider this a poor man's copyright, okay? Because if anybody steals my album, I swear to God, I will come teabag you so hard. And then our lawyers will talk. But the teabag comes first. But I am actively working on an album right now called Within the Rocks. And the concept, I do a lot of strange, esoteric electronic music, things like that.
Oh, that's cool.
And the concept is behind all of these petroglyphs across the globe are similar geometric patterns.
Yes.
And yep. When you look at them, like if you're an electronics nerd like me and you do like singular synthesis where it's like, yeah, I got a square wave generator. Some of these things look straight up like waveform generation. So the concept is, what if these artists were synesthetic and were actively showing us the waveform of the sound that they heard?
And that's
I am taking the images, tracing out these forms, and then putting them through an algorithm that turns image into music. And the sounds that come out are amazing. Amazing.
And so imagine these Greek Roman amphitheaters, and everyone's, you know, they do a tour and they crumple a dollar bill and say, see how you can hear it everywhere.
I heard a match light from the top of the amphitheater in Delphi, a match.
Yeah. And what if it was actually a center for you receiving? What if it was you receiving like Anthony Holland's work, Royal Rife's work that Anthony Holland picked up and cured MRSA, destroyed MRSA, destroyed leukemia, destroyed all these cancers. And what if those are actually receiving centers? You and I walk in, you have a cold, I have cancer, but we sit there. We're not just watching a play. We're receiving frequencies and waves that are healing by the group.
Well, especially whenever you're talking about ancient Greek theater, things like that, you had things such as the chorus that were chanting in the background, that kind of stuff, as performance went on, even.
And this dynastic work, when we look at, oh, by the way, geek out on the giant megalithic stone spheres that everyone thinks, oh, there's these stone spheres that are 64 tons, the one they found in Bosnia. And then Costa Rica, most famously, you know, that's where they started with the banana plantations. They're like, well, you know, if you're really important. And then for a while, people were saying, hey, they're perfectly round. And then someone started to point out, well, they're not all perfectly round, but they are very interesting. Well, that was also some of the scientific papers I quote. They were doing experiments with 1 meter by 1 meter stone spheres. And that's where they came up with the theory of wave resonators as these stone spheres. And I want to point out, especially since you're a wave, especially with the music in the background, you see where I'm going? I think the spheres were different sizes and shapes based on the waves they were supposed to be, like a series of bells in a tower. And so what they
found, even oblong and things like that would make things resonate at a different frequency, especially when put inside of the same space.
Exactly. And what they found in the studies that they were doing as in reference to seismic metamaterials, which is the studies of things that help buildings not fall down in earthquakes, was that if you put a series, not one, but a series, and I include the photo in the book, not to scale, but to place a series of stone spheres under not one building, but a whole city complex.
Yeah.
That they would work to cancel or amplify, i.e. wave resonators, because these stone spheres, thank God people were greedy and decided that gold or treasure was in them. They started blowing them up. So we have two things that we get to do with stone spheres that any of you out there that are near them, because they're all over. They're from the Arctic to China to Costa Rica. They're in Bosnia. They're all over the world. And by the way, some are as small as golf balls. But the question about the big ones are in New Zealand, And in Mexico, they started busting them open because they thought that there was gold and stuff in them, but they found out that they were hollow. And the deal is, what are they cast out of? What does that material science say? Do they have a surface skin on them?
Yeah.
Is there any nanoarchaeological evidence of that? And then the shapes. Let's get us, i.e. people interested in frequencies and sound. What does a material, is it quartz? Is it a feldspar? Is it a mixture? Like, why is granite so mixed? Well, we could geek out, but the point is, what are the shapes of those frequencies that these things are amplifying or muting or receiving or sending? And how does the hollow center affect the muting and or transmutation of that wave?
And
how is it affected around this electromagnetic soil around it?
I've got some data pulled up on screen right now from Cornell University. Dynamics of an acoustically trapped sphere embedding sound waves. Now, this would be pretty much what we're talking about. An acoustically trapped sphere inside of beating sound waves. That would mean like a couple of spheres vibrating against each other inside of a cavity, anything like that. And a focused acoustic standing wave creates a Hookean potential well for a small sphere and can levitate it stably against gravity, exposing the trapped sphere to a second transverse traveling sound wave, imposes an additional acoustic force that drives the sphere away from its mechanical equilibrium. The driving force is shaped by interference between the standing trapped wave and the traveling driving. So, wild stuff. Talking about
dudes and beer.
Levitating things against. This is Cornell University, man.
And no one said, what about all these giant stone spheres that look kind of like eggs and stuff?
Where is this? Why? And this is why we have these conversations, because it's like, why the hell do you hear the same 8 stories every friggin' day when there's crap like this? Dude, once again, I have it up on screen. Submitted. I'm going to enlarge it on screen, folks. Submitted August 29th, 2020. This was the day after my birthday. How did this even miss my radar? Because my radar is like a wide swath for crazy stuff like this, my man. But the fact that this skipped my radar is amazing to me. But the fact that it didn't make mainstream news is not.
No, but I've been thinking about this stuff forever. And I've been going down this road now for 5 years of a very advanced group of humans were here. They had genetic technology. They had all the ancillary technology that matches this technology. And somehow they survived. And I don't think it was the smartest of the group. I think that it was a hodgepodge. Like, again, you know, you lose a power grid. You want to revert to the dark ages and wear two things of something that don't work. To begin with, you can do all that. And before you know it, you have a society after a few massive cataclysms and some war, which has been witnessed throughout the ages. The reality is that you could end up with a society that had to rebuild their very own high technology. And when they've left the surface, you could easily identify someone that has adapted their body to 0.25 G turns in a tic tac to having smaller, large black eyed infrared scannable wave frequency eyeballs that have direct mind control to their flying machine, which is really just human technology and they genetically modded. But that, getting back on the mind blowing,
dude, that is exactly we need to get you on with Mike Turber. Because our whistleblower and friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News, who we talked about at the beginning of the show in our Facebook news section, that is what he and I have been saying about this Tic Tac UFO thing the whole time, is that every bit of action shows that they were not intent on engaging this at all. Here was a craft that was in our water, unresponsive to command. Typically, that would be like, hey, somebody scramble an armed escort. No, instead it was follow and observe. And after they got back, like one branch of the military hopped onto the other branch of the military's craft and said, give me all that data, and just took it away. Which really more sounds like somebody testing some uber secret technology against our own known quantitative.
And what you just pointed out, when you strip away the mysticisms and paradigms and the indoctrinated this is your starting point for our indoctrinated theories.
Yeah.
When you strip all that away, you see an article like the one you just read, mm-hmm. and you apply it to something like, wait a minute, potentially floating stone spheres.
Now, don't get me wrong, because I'm going to bring it back up on screen and read the last part, dude, because the last part will trip your brain. Far from behaving like a textbook-driven harmonic oscillator, however, the wave-driven harmonic oscillator instead exhibits a remarkably rich variety of dynamic behaviors arising from the spatial dependence of the driving force. These include oscillations at both harmonic and subharmonic of the driving frequency, period doubling roots to chaos and Fibonacci cascades. This model system therefore illustrates opportunities for dynamic acoustic manipulation on spectral control of the sound field rather than spatial control. And once again, like Cornell University, this is a study that they did in their physics department, and it just blows my mind because, once again, we are utterly spoon-fed one thing from the media. But at the same time, if you follow all of, as my grandfather would say, if you follow the tricks, you'll get some gumbo. And if you follow all the rabbit trails, you'll end up with some gumbo. And there's so many rabbit trails out there right now, and that's all that people see is rabbit trail. They do not see the end product. They do not see the concept of, quote, soft disclosure. And the fact that as we slowly roll it, there's only one way we're going to be able to just like, dude, we are actively talking about hypersonic missile technology. Where the hell you think that came from, Jack?
I try to tell people how terrified they should be.
Only thing we have hypersonic missiles for is to intercept something that's hypersonic or faster.
Right.
Like, literally. So, it blows my mind how it has to jump to the sci-fi realm. It really doesn't have to be the sci-fi realm. Most people do not realize the fact that what we know as that threshold of technology that I guess at one point it was the what was it? The calculation that gave us how many transistors could fit on a circuit at one point. Anyway, we have utterly crashed that concept.
We did.
Like that disappeared a few years ago. And the fact that we now have machines that can pass Turing tests, that kind of stuff is just phenomenal. So to know that, here's a Cornell University study talking about rotating spheres inside of an enclosed space, creating a harmonic anti-gravity, levitation field, kind of sounds like what the Nazis were working with. Kind of sounds like what we've worked with on numerous occasions. Just wild stuff to see it out there.
It is. I think something could really be seriously reverse engineered on the part that doesn't get spoken about is on the stone spheres in particular.
Absolutely.
Is that one. Is the size of them. So what would you do with ones that have the same function that are only the size of golf balls that they find? And so were there machines or were there things? Are they, and again, we're talking about like the schist disk, you know, are we talking about, yeah. We have very limited pieces of technology from our pre-dynastic lives. And that's the issue. The first and foremost in our is when you see giant megalithic blocks mixed in with mud brick, you're not talking about the same group of people. You do not, as a builder or a contractor, start with 100-ton stones.
Yeah, yeah. You don't start with precision and then end with crap.
No,
that just comes from somebody who works in the realm of high-end AV. Somebody paid us a lot of money to get this job done right, and I am not going to just like, yeah, I can polish poop. You know what the problem is? You end up with poop on everything.
Yeah, but it's polished.
It doesn't matter how good the work was before. There's poop all over it now. And it's the same thing. Like you said, whenever you look at places like Ollantaytambo. Yeah.
Ollantaytambo.
Whenever you look at facilities like that, it really is just bricks laid on top of precision work. And that's much more.
They don't even have the depths down. They don't have the foundations down. Yeah. They don't know the depths. They were looking for gold and silver. So the very perspective, or to tell the last 1,000 or 2 years, real interesting. I think every human being and their memory is worth telling. But we have ruins that have been occupied possibly for tens of thousands of years. We have standing stones across the earth,
yeah.
Like at Karnak, and that have clearly structural supports to what were once super constructions that right now our commercial structures are 20 feet tall of concrete, and the rest are 5, 8, 10 stories of wood. Now, they're building apartment buildings that are all wood for 8 or 10 stories above a parking garage and a first floor of concrete, of spancrete. And when you look at the lentils and pillars and these new buildings that are going up as fast as they can build loft studio apartments, at least here in the Twin Cities, if the entire thing burned down and the rest was repurposed, all you'd have left is what looks like the standing stones at Karnak.
Yeah.
It'd be it.
Well, and it's interesting because when you go to a lot of these cultures and ask them where it came from, they tell you that when they started using it, it was there.
Yes.
We didn't build it. We just found it and started using it.
Even the Greeks, it was like, who built? Well, the gods built this before the temple in Delphi. But the temple. Yeah, the gods built this. It's everywhere and all the time. And then either way, it's so the memory of the actual peoples that were using it originally, which so when I've been only recently discussing this, is that folks, we need to stop looking at, I mean, not stop looking. We need to know what happened around the Younger Dryas, but we kind of think that before the Younger Dryas, you know, that's when this society was still earthly supreme. And I have a feeling that the reason that cities off the coast of Cuba at 2,300 feet deep, and the reason the Recot structure is now 7,800 feet above sea level, the Eye of Africa, is above water, even though it shows signs of being a bay and being at sea level. And Lake Titicaca in South America is at about 12,600, 13,000 feet. Why? And it has salt water with seahorses, which a high-tech, genetically advanced society could easily salt water it and put in seahorses. But let's just assume that there's been a lot of upheavals here and there and around. But what are we talking about between that super volcano at 75,000 years and that Younger Dryas period? I think that's the window I was nailing it between 55 and 60,000 years ago, but it could be that maybe we're off on the 70,000 year, but somewhere in that window is, I think, when this global megalithic society got whacked. And then did they stay on the surface? I mean, the father of geopolymers, Dr. Joseph David Ovitz, who they've cited, they've set papers out that some of the blockage at Tiwanaku appears, or Pumapunku, either site, they appear to be geopolymers. Mm. And Is it
now,
possible?
Explain, because a lot of people may not understand. I work a lot of corporate AV, and within that is the world of petrochemical. So I am used to sitting through a polyfin and olefin session for 2 hours. All right. I understand what a polymer is. that is just from sheer exposure and absorption in the in the corporate environment. However, not a lot of people It's not. I get paid to play with people's expensive toys all day. There's nothing painful about that. I don't care what I have to sit through. I could be actually working for a living. But
stop telling people that.
let's get into what that concept actively means real quick.
So nobody makes, like you said, nobody makes concrete that lasts anymore. Yeah. The earth would be like, just what would Detroit look like, for instance, after
we lost the Roman formula for concrete, and that cured underwater in like hours.
So we have the Roman concrete, which is the one of the best examples, which, by the way, in quotes, we have the Greeks. And then before that, the alleged again, kind of like the Clovis people in North America, we have the Etruscans.
Yeah.
And then we have the Greeks, and then we have the Romans, and then we have this recipe for a concrete that does not need rebar. It does not need any metal reinforcement. It is so strong. We have this massive unsupported dome that a lot of people think of all these Roman, or again, the Greeks had abandoned things that the Romans took and or had occupied, but then readapted to be Roman. But what we also have is this large rabbit hole for later, the Tartaria, the Tartarians, a world empire that may include the Etruscans, but we'll sidestep it because we have architecture from Mongolia to Greece.
Feel
looks
free
very
to
similar.
Just reference the friggin' aquifers that still exist to this day from Rome.
Yes. And so the question is, and the theory all along for alternative and truth seeking historical, you know, just anyone with the interest, is how much from the Romans, the Greeks, the Etruscans, and further back are just items they found, not only adapted, but they also, remember, folks, when people live with things, they repair them. If you have a home that's even 10 or 5 years old, you update things, you repair things, you replace things. Nobody in dynastic period just said, well, this is as good as it gets. They restacked blocks. They found aqueducts that were functioning, and they mimicked and they repaired and they adapted and they used materials they could do to improve upon ruins that were already there in pre-dynastic periods.
And they even learned from the Etruscan society, don't make all your drinking vessels out of lead.
You would think they would have. It doesn't have electrolytes. It does not have what plants crave.
But yeah, you know,
So
they learned from each other. They learned from their own mistakes, even at the time. But to know that they, even to this day, have one of the best mixes of concrete known to man.
Right. Which. Yeah, and so we still – we think – I know there's been some articles, but I've not seen any scientific articles on it that we think we sort of worked it out again. But still, this is – we're building skyscrapers, and we are for sure using rebar. These people are building the largest domes and stadiums, and they're doing everything they can with a recipe of concrete that's not only so strong, but here's a mystery item. There are bays that have been found in the Mediterranean that are no longer bays, but there's been material science researchers that have been more open in Europe, I feel, in the last 5 to 10 years, that they're testing and they're saying, well, okay, it turns out that this is not a new bay. It's, you know, they've tested things that are appear like Teflon, that have qualities. Geopolymers are things that are added within concrete that make concrete stronger or work underwater or work in cold or work in heat.
Yeah.
And again, there's a chemical reaction. So geopolymers are additives that Dr. Joseph David Ovitz came up with and brilliantly came up with in the early 70s. He won the highest science awards that France can give. He still runs the Geopolymer Institute. It's kind of weird, but it's like the god of geopolymers literally still lives. And they had looked at some of the materials that were within very famously, there's these things called the H blocks, and they're just a piece at Tiwanaku that appear to be cast, and because they're different sizes. And at first people thought, oh, they're all the same size. Well, they got pointed out that they're not the same size. But the point is they look like a piece of a building, a construction or architecture. They look like the letter H. But they published a paper that said, well, it appears that these are actually – it's a cast creation of just like a concrete that it's cast. And so I like to point out now, if we start building a new picture of a high-tech human race that loses its world status, there's all these rock-cut ruins that are showing signs that for long periods of time, humans definitely did live or work underground. And we're not talking primitive people. I'm talking – very peculiar, very well cut rock cut ruins, like even famously Buzz Aldrin and Eric Von Daniken went to look at some in South America. But here we are with these geopolymers from bays in the Mediterranean that appear there's no mollusks, there's no barnacles, there's nothing on them. It's as if they're Teflon, and they're testing and they're finding that it's not just these Roman or in quotes Roman constructions. That the recipe, and again, the recipe, just like descending information, like the Pythagorean theorem from the Babylonian Plimpton tablet. And one I haven't mentioned, the YBC tablet that has what basically is a hexadecimal 60 based sort of a spherical based geometrical math that would be very useful if you're making, well, not only things in 3D, but using eigenvalues. And here's these geopolymers being used not just in dynastic Roman periods, but prior. We're finding cast stones. And for a society that 70,000 years ago, 60,000 years ago falls apart. But here are the Greeks getting a story from Solon, from the Egyptians, about you Greeks actually being very old, but you're very young now, but you come from a very old and a very strong, you know, the legend and as it all goes. What if Atlantis, not representing a place, but representing a period of high technology? But let's take the Eye of Africa and the Rikat structure. What if, like that, and what if, like in Lake Titicaca region in Peru that and Bolivia, that this idea of geopolymers in the H blocks, what if what we're seeing is the last time advanced humans chose to live in the open, on the surface, with anybody willy-nilly still being able to walk up to the door and knock? And eventually, they abandoned that model entirely, and there is nothing left but dynastic surviving earth-wandering cultures. And ultimately, the H-blocks and Tiwanaku and Pumapunku and Ollantaytambo and Sacsayhuaman and everywhere that everyone like Cusco, all the places in Mexico and Central America, Guatemala, those 60,000 buildings that have recently been found in LIDAR scans. What if all of it is dynastic peoples rebuilding, readapting, abandoned high technology sites? Meanwhile, a smaller group of more advanced humans that decided, you know, we can't reconnect this global circuitry. We just don't. We need to have a certain amount of total human RAM. We need to get back to a human population that we're just not at yet. So, well, we can't help everybody. And, well, you know, the last time Bill gave them religion, look what they did. You know, thank you for the whole Aztec, you know, murdering God thing, Bill.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Hope you enjoyed all the hearts.
Yeah, you know, it's like Valentine's Day wasn't supposed to look like that, Bill.
And it's yeah, that's not what we meant. And I've actively got the Geopolymer Institute, geopolymer.org up. I'm not sure if you're aware of their work.
Yeah, I have tried to get on my on Conflict Radio. I co-host, and I tried to get. I've been wanting to get Dr. Joseph David Ovitz. He does still do interviews.
Let's just pincher move him.
Oh God, whatever we can do, man. If we can body slam him and tag team this
straight up,
oh, that'd be brilliant.
Straight up, because I mean, it's an interesting concept because I have never, and you know, granted, the concept has been floated for years of high energy molten rock.
Yeah,
you know, using high energy frequencies to melt the rock to get the fitting that exists in these Neolithic huge structures.
Yep.
Just phenomenally huge, even to scale on modern humanity. Huge. But to see the work that they have put forth, and let's do it. I'll do it.
Yeah. Because yeah. He did a whole thing on, because I do talk about this in the book. He did do a theoretical look into the Great Pyramid, and they found instances. So this is my point about long-term use and repair and management, whether it was some sort of scary hypersonic scalar weapon or something else, or internal issues. The reality is that
take a hypersonic scaling weapon if you're using piezoelectric earth and compacting it to 100%.
Yeah, and what if you have a power where source. You need to, and you gotta be able to patch things. So when they are confused about, like, the Great Pyramid, they're constantly looking at it going, well, it got built once.
Yeah.
No, it got built and then it got managed and repaired and maintained and got new siding.
Yeah.
And during that period, Dr. Joseph David Ovitz had put out the theory that, well, what if the whole thing, well, there was the theory ruminating that maybe the whole thing is just a giant pile of concrete. And so they test a few pieces and they find, well, it turns out there is some geopolymer here. But what we don't know, it looks like it's a pre-dynastic patching. Well, it was backed up by two others. One, it was backed up by an Egyptian scientist, and it was backed up by a Yale scientist independently saying, yeah, there appears to be geopolymer patching at least in use on this structure. And now you have Tiwanaku with indications of geopolymer, and that doesn't make a lot of people happy.
Well, I can see quite honestly, and like we talk about on this show all the time, and even with guests outside in private conversation, how it can unrest the boat, even in the camp that you're in.
Yeah, there's not even agreement. Alternative, because, it's like, just as bad.
This is crazy sauce, man. Like, just going through and reading this guy's work at geopolymer.org, and this is no endorsement for them. This is not like a sideways endorsement of them. But literally what popped up when I started doing what I do on air, which is just Google stalking stuff as we talk about it. And to literally read about them talking about the same thing that you're talking about, man. Geopolymers. The fact of these things were quite possibly a poured form, which explains their uniformity and precision.
Yeah, and just for everyone out there, if you can find Dr. Joseph David Ovitz's short bio, you should read it to people.
Brother, believe me, my job, as I told you before the show, used to be Google stalking people. I will find this man.
I think it's worth people hearing when people think, you know, if you have a home, a modern.
Like, this is stuff that, don't get me wrong, I have followed the stories of Oyente Tambo. I have followed the stories of Tiwanaku. I have followed every one of these for years. But to think about the fact, and it makes perfect sense, because absolutely the molding technology at the time, especially if you go back and look at ancient Grecian temples and look at, you know, like the Parthenon, things like that. The precision with which every single column is the same. Yes, was carving, but at the same time, that was known technology, and they definitely used molds. They definitely used concrete formula, especially in Rome, stuff like that. So to think that this is anything different, you know, especially when you're talking andesite, that kind of stuff, really, really forward thinking.
Yes, and it's not that, and again, it's not. It's limited to not just these above ground constructions. It's underwater areas. Again, yeah. A massive amount of not just bays and areas where a geopolymer would be useful. Also, as a side note, for single item pillars, Baalbek, Lebanon gets pointed out all the time about the large stones that are in the quarry that are, you know, 800, 900, 1100, 1200 tons,
yep.
And that they're part of this construction. And clearly the temple at Baalbek is oddly restacked and rebuilt. It's very odd. And then at the Temple Mount, they were going to do construction and 40 to 60 feet underground. Voila, they find the same size blocks and the same kind of construction. And then that was even looked at and measured. I mean, there's a block that's like 11 feet by 14 feet by 8 feet estimated. Yeah. And that was done by the University of Eau Claire. But I bring it up because Baalbek, the part that gets left out is there's a facade of the building where there's some tall pillars, 45 to 60 feet, give or take, depending on the pillar. Now, there was over 200 when they were found in the last couple of 100 years in modern times. What they don't say is that some of them, out of some of the hardest stones on earth, they're single-piece columns. They're perfectly hewn. They're 60 feet of a single piece. So how did someone cut that and perfectly lay it to the correct column size? Because they have bellies,
yep,
and they're perfect. They're one piece.
Yeah, they're constructed in that classic style where they extend in the middle to make them look straight from a distance.
And they have beautiful tops, but they're literally one piece.
Yeah,
no breaks.
Yeah,
no,
Corinthian, no imperfections. Corinthian capitals, utterly decorated on top. But like you said,
60 feet
seem to be poured almost.
Yeah, and I'm not even saying that it's because it's a geopolymer, but did you stalk Dr. Joseph David Ovitz? Did you find him?
I haven't yet. I don't do that live on air because I don't. Okay.
Sorry, everybody.
A, I don't want to encourage people to do that. B, I don't want them to see my secrets, man.
And, oh no, yeah, no.
And
I
how
just want
I stalk
the bio,
people?
Because you know?
Yeah, believe me, you know, we'll find him.
The bio. Yeah, and the bio on him is just incredible. Like, what the man's a living Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, absolutely.
The man, what he's invented. So I wasn't directly relating the columns to being poured, but we do have weird things like the Romanian growing rocks.
Mm.
And that's an interesting search for people.
Yeah.
There are rocks that appear to grow as if they're the leftover compounds, mixtures of maybe an ancient concrete mix. Also, another weird thing, and for all those geologists out there, it's an odd granite is not a thing. Like, lava is a thing. But
yeah.
Granite has an odd consistency of a number of different crystals and stones.
Yeah, it's feldspar, carbon, quartz, even like living here in Texas. I grew up granite all over the place, specifically the pink rock. The pink granite of Texas is highly sought after. It's what makes our capital look the way it does.
There's a lot of rose granite in Egypt.
Yeah. Slightly taller than the U.S. Capitol Rare note.
All right. Well, and because Texas is its own country.
That's
anyway,
right.
So it's not even comparable.
But to go into that, to start talking about the fact of granted in and of itself is an interesting conglomerate.
Isn't it?
In the way that it's formed, in the way that it happens.
And that's the interesting thing. We don't actually have a solid explanation on that one. Really?
No. But not geologically in the way that it happens, in the regularity that it happens, and in the way that it happens.
That's awkward, isn't it?
Yeah. it's just weird because I'm a rock hound, you know, and I love rocks. I love minerals. And granite is one of those things that it's just weird. It's just this weird thing that just kind of happens between quartz, carbon, and feldspar. And in right. different and combinations. And in, really, the only thing that varies is feldspar and the quantity of the three and the type of feldspar.
Right. And it's and this is just one of those cases of give me just a theory on the hypothetical surface geological. What mixing machine got it to these quantities? And when you slice pieces, how did the Earth jumble it randomly to this consistency?
I don't have it here in front of me. Otherwise, I would show it to the camera. But one of my favorite places on Earth, hopefully, God willing, someday I will be like Art Bell. And this show will be coming to you from Marfa, Texas. but one of the formations there is because it's a very volcanic area, things like that, is chalcedony. And it occurs in almost the same kind of formation where it's rapidly cooling magma is what causes granite, things like that. And the minerals that are around it are what cause the coloration and the sedimentary type of feldspar that is there, whether it's gray or pink or white or what have you. But it's always those real three things, and it's always in a highly volcanic area that you find that's one reason why we have it here. Like it's an odd area here in the hill country of Texas, because not only do we have that volcanic history, but you can go out in some parts in I know in Upper Dallas and even here in the hill country and find like fossilized sea ruins. Find like fossilized shark teeth, stuff like that.
I got to go to Coral Castle for the first time.
Oh, God. I've never hated a guest until now, but go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm just I was there, and what blew my mind was they're explaining that, you know, he built it out of the the coral rock that's there. And they said, did you know that all of Florida is really just a giant calcified coral reef? And they said, okay, that's interesting. They said, well, at this point right here where Coral Castle is, at this point, it's 4,000 to 4,400-ish feet deep.
Wow.
So that's how much coral is there. So all of Florida, it's almost like a wedge of all the way to the main section of the United States, that entire Florida boot is actually a wedge of ancient coral that goes to 4,400 plus feet deep. It's not granite. It's not some other stone. It's actually the entire dang state is basically a coral reef.
It's nothing but like limestone, like what we're built on here in Austin almost. Nothing but old sea schist.
Oh, yeah. And that brings us back to we now have table geopolymers and a crapload of wonderfully interesting Egan values. And now We have stone cut. We mentioned the giant columns and Baalbek and the giant stones and their functionaries beyond just being giant blocks. But what we also could do is in Saqqara, the Step Pyramid, they found over 40,000 vases that are machine lathed. And some of them are out of the most complex quartz filled, fragile. Like, how did they cut out of a solid piece of stone vases? Some are really big, some are really small, but they found over 40,000 of them, and they had the crappiest mud lids on them that you could ever imagine a third grade class making with clay. It's like, make a lid for this pot. And yet they're saying, oh no, these are the same people who made these. Some of these are made out of such delicate stone that if a machine was cutting them and they even caught a crystal, it should have shattered the vase. And some are so thin, they're said to be translucent. And these are made out of stone. And they were repurposed and reused, and they were found in the Step Pyramid. But you have things like that and the schist disc, and you have obsidian objects that are found in these spools that they said, oh yeah, they were for yarn. And it's like, really? They use some of the most complex, delicate crystals and jades and schists and fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And we can't replicate. Yeah. We don't even have a concept of a water jet cutter, of a laser cutter, of a lathe cutter, we don't have a CNC in mind that could recreate these objects.
Even now, holding up to the camera, I have, and granted, this is not the one from Joshua Shapiro. I do have a crystal skull from Joshua Shapiro coming to me fully charged, but this is a crystal skull that I had ordered before that. And even to do this, even for the craftsman to do what he did with this takes incredible modern technology to make something the size of my fist, greater than slightly, and almost 2 pounds of quartz, takes diamond bits, high fast rotation, things like that. And to know that our ancient counterparts in South America and across the globe were making these with hand-hewn tools, with tools that were quite obviously sharper than the quartz that they were carving or the rock that they were carving, which meant that they were at the least precious stone, you know, sapphire, yeah, diamond, ruby, corundum, things like that. To be able to polish stone to that point, to be able to work stone to that point and carve it to that point, much less carving it out of a single piece of rock without issue. So to say that it took extraordinary technology is, I would say, not necessary. To say that it took extraordinary knowledge, yes. Extraordinary craftsmanship that even to this day goes into things. The only difference is the man hours that go into it. At the time that they were made, the reason why they were so few is because it took tens of thousands of man hours to make one. Like, literally somebody's almost entire life of sculpting to make one. Which is why there were so few, you know.
And as far as these ancient vases and containers, they're not consistent with the lids that they're found with.
Yeah,
and it's so. And again, you start logging in other anomalies, and it's not about, hey, I'm going to collect everything and, you know, build a society that, you know, didn't priorly exist. The issue to me is the similarities and the techniques of the constructions, the issues, the values in whether it is an eigenvalue, whether it's a high technology, we're still in the ground going, let's find a pyramid, let's find a building, let's find a temple, let's find something sacred. There's no one out there. Like, I just saw an article recently, and you might have seen it too, about I'm going to call it nano archaeology, that the sedimentary remnants on Dogger Land off the coast of France that they were able to test despite the seawater, from the sedimentary remains underwater, they were able to start determining the botanical content of Dogger Land from sediments, seawater.
Wow.
And this is the flora and fauna of Dogger Land that they're talking about, which is definitely big time. 8 to 15,000 years ago, you could definitely still walk from Ireland, Scotland, you name it, all the way back to France if you wanted. And now, of course, it's just islands. The Baltic Sea is a sea. In reality, it used to be a lake. So was the Mediterranean. And I spent a lot of time working out a map in my book. And the reality is idea of sedimentary research, of looking at the finite granulars to find what ultimately, getting back to it, engineered soil. And what that means isn't just for growing. Right now, when I went paleo about 10 years ago, I was looking for, and I wasn't familiar with aeroponics yet, which I'm a huge fan of, is that I was learning all about nutrients in soil, and that not all food is grown in highly nutritious soil. It might genetically be modified to be a big, giant, pretty tomato, but if it's grown in sand, it's probably not that nutritious. And I'm like, what's the best growing soil on Earth? I had actually come across Terra Preta and didn't think anything of it because it wasn't associated with it being a mystery. It was associated with, be careful, don't get caught. You know, they export it. And in the Ukraine, it's called Chernozems. It's a different kind of engineered soil, but it's in Ukraine, and they export it illegally for growing plants and for food, because there's a professor in Kansas that's been looking at it, that they also oddly can't determine why it seems to self-generate, that it seems to self-maintain, and it has heavy metal filtering abilities. It filters carbon dioxide. So you have to look at the soil. And I realized and I bring this up because I hadn't thought of it when I was looking for nutritious soil to grow food that would have high nutrient value. Later it occurred to me, there's aeroponics. You can completely control everything. And we're 3D printing meat now. So it occurs to me that what if you have a global society that has way more people than we have in it now, based on now we're doing nanoarchaeology and finding engineered soil in deserts that we thought were abandoned, never populated, let alone, again, a lineal assumption that we are the most populated now as we've ever been, when in reality, we may not be as populated as we are now as we ever were, that this soil has the qualities it does because it did manage carbon dioxide. It did manage heavy metals. It did manage not only for communication and energy transfers and communication, sending, receiving, but that actually beyond that, there is a human population that right now, if you put them all on an acre, every human being on the planet would fit in about 2.5 Texases, 2 Texases.
Yeah.
Right now. So what do we do with an entire planet that's actually quite empty? But back in the day, if we start establishing and mapping that the entire planet was once terraformed,
not take that long. A prime example that I give people, I am from Texas, but I lived in Maine for 5 years of my life. And one of the wildest places that I took people that came to Maine to visit me, I'm bringing it up on screen now, the desert of Maine. Look it up. It is the only desert east of the Mississippi. But it is quite literally the result of a sheep farmer who did not rotate his sheep and ate not only the grass, but the roots of the grass. And eventually, his entire place, numerous acres, just became a barren desert, like the Dust Bowl. in the 20s, and to this day is still a desert. And it's a tourist attraction, all kinds of stuff. But it's a prime example of how fast that can happen. How fast you can actively turn a prime piece of real estate that was good for raising sheep into a friggin' desert.
Wow. That's
by not doing it right. By not doing it right.
Yep. And that's just such a brilliant example. It's so important for people to get their there's so many balls to throw in the air to get your head around to see it. And it's not I need to convince you. It's look, no. There's just a bunch of facts. Get rid of the paradigms of the theories. Just table the adult archaeological clue game of it was the polygonal masonry with the Egan values and the professor in the library. You know, it's they're
I love it. Absolutely.
We have this massive mental barrier with there are genetic researchers that are like, well, there seems to be a lot of weird cuts in the human genome and they happened not recently. And then, okay, so you guys know that there's a mystery 14% human. Okay, well, is any one of you going to have the nuts to pick up the Paracas? Are any of you? Or any of the elongated races that are found around the very Egyptian statues? I mean, yeah. Everywhere there's elongated skulls. And they're not smashed head tribes mimicking cultures.
Yeah, the globe over that do not have the same suture lines in their skull, the same biological features that we have.
Right. And so you jump over to the east and India, Japan, all over are filled with megalithic constructions, and all of them are similar. So you gotta just go with, okay, well, what are all of these buildings doing having this? Well, let's have a list of things that the various sciences check every time. Let's start not only plugging for an engineered soil as in, oh, I put my hand in it like it's gladiator before a battle here. It's wait, what is the compaction level? Was there a settlement here? Was there a large construction here? Was the consistency of the soil under the drifted sand dune the consistency of a pre-compacted electronic switching system? Was it part of a polygonal construction? Is there indications? And again, I think there was
an organization to what? Go ahead.
Also to how they laid out trees. I think that that's in the papers I read for the cymatic work that they were even laying out trees, mixing soil, and dealing with the pylons would all relate to even creating cymatic, you know, like safe zones.
Interesting.
Wave safe zones.
Interesting. Yeah. To create purposeful buffers against waves.
Yes. Yeah. And I'll get you those papers on that. But we that we are building back very quickly. And again, remembering abilities like synesthesia, there are various things. So for some people, it's for people who aren't familiar, there's things like you can hear a word and smell something, or you smell something, but you see a number, or you hear a number and you smell something or a color.
You hear a sound, you see a color.
Right. So there's different, or you see someone touch someone else and you actually feel the touch. That's a synesthesia ability. Wow. There are so many. And right now, Carl Jung, the Greeks, everybody was looking into synesthesia. They were aware of it. And they say right now the estimate is, well, we think like 25, 30% of the population has this ability. Okay. But Is it really a random ability, or is it part of our safe mode? Is it an ability that once indicated higher functionality? Because if you could sense other, how far away do you have to be before you are actually don't need a cell phone? You're actually connecting, feeling, sensing, smelling not only other people and things and plants and animals, but what if you could walk up? Your job today is to work on this cymatic polygonal building, and you walk up. My analogy would be is imagine having a Walkman, an iPod. Oh, wait, no, let's go even fast forward. You got your MP3 player on your phone and you're listening to your favorite Led Zeppelin tune.
Yeah.
And you can actually see, because of the music, your architectural plan and your high-tech instrument to shape the block in front of you is showing you without goggles, without anything, colors that are literally imposed on the block, and you remove those colors and that's the shape of the block that needs to be for the next position.
Well, and it's interesting because our listener and friend of the show, James Dancer, said on our chat feature that if you look at this, if people were microdosing psilocybin, things like this, that kind of stuff would already be just a known quantitative. You know,
oh, that's so cool.
Just the idea that this kind of information is out there would already be a known quantitative. It wouldn't even be something that would be questioned. So to go into that for just a second. Yeah, there is kind of that esoteric capital T truth that kind of happens even geocosmically amongst teachings. And even, you know, like we were saying earlier, whenever you look at things like the circle of the sun in Nazca, which is quite verily almost a mandala in and of itself, and the geometric shape and the way it takes on and the neighboring pattern next to it. It almost just kind of screams at you once you start putting these things together and seeing the fact that, even Babylonian texts were talking about these concepts.
Yeah, there are so many truths that and slivers of truths and deified and mystified truths that it's easy and it is fun. Don't get me wrong, it is fun to go off and talk about Anunnaki and things that are post-flood, post-diluvian stories, and you can and it is a good time, but we have a greater mystery, and I'm not always having to look over the next, you know, it's kind of like being at the old used CD place and you're constantly flipping. You don't know why, but you're gonna flip every CD there, find the one we are here in a historical mystery that involves not just our origin, but I touched on it for a hot second, Wim Hof, the Iceman, 26 world records, climbs Mount Everest in shorts. I got to meet him and participate in the first American. It was me and three friends. And it was the very first time he came to America. And I learned how to do Wim Hof from Wim Hof. And it was quite amazing on Treasure Island in San Fran. And I've been a practitioner for a long time, and it's a way to not only consciously control your immune system, your inflammatory response, and be able to regulate your heat and your cold when you're in 20 below weather or you're in really warm weather.
Yeah.
And it's not just that. It's also a breathing technique with a meditation that isn't you need to worry about your problems. And I mean, the minute you start doing this breathing technique and the Wim Hof method, you do not need to be told what to think about. There's a switch that goes off. Mm. And your superhuman, if you want to call it, right now it's called superhuman, but the first thing he says in class, it was effing, he doesn't say it that way, but he says, effing demystify. You want an effing prayer? He throws his hands together and goes, there you go. Ooh, he goes, effing demystify. You can do this. We forgot we could do this, and we mystified it. And I can't preach that enough, that we have physical abilities and programming. It's programming. Yes. We're finding, back to that vibrational medicine, we're finding electronic switch. Woo! Yeah. And touchdown. Metaphysical touchdown.
That's it.
Into the esoteric reality.
Because it really is just that fact of, like, we have just forgotten. That's all. We've just forgotten. There is that capital T universal truth. There is that concept out there. There is that means by which to gain enlightenment in a larger sense, but you have to be willing to sacrifice what you know as you. You have to be willing to sacrifice what you know as the norm in order to achieve that. And you really do have to be willing to accept that though you have influence, there is a current of movement that you are only a part of.
It's this mystery. Everything we're talking about is exciting and fun. I really do think this for people out there, because connecting these points, the spider web, it is relevant to being more connected, more present, happier, and ultimately not murdering each other over just ludicrous positions on fill in the blank. And the reality is that there isn't an us and them. This is a connected world.
Yeah.
And we can mourn the loss of the greater connection of it, but it is very uncomfortable when you start with not theories, but the facts of, let's just take Terra Preta itself. The exact Terra Preta is found not just in Brazil, and currently they're just estimating it to be the tune of, well, we think it's an area about the size of two Great Britains or two Spains. But the identical Terra Preta is found in other countries in South America and in North Africa and basically in Australia. So what are we doing with an identical recipe like those amphora and the cocaine? That's all post-flood. That's all just dynastic peoples remembering old maps and knowing that the world is bigger than they knew the world was big. And then we'll just keep ignoring the fact that Chinese admirals completely made it to South and North and Central America.
Yeah.
And yet those just, again, it's like woo-woo, you know, nothing over there. Qigong, I get all the Eastern techniques, the proof of the meridians and the chakras not being mystical, but being actual human diagnostics, like the meridians actually being real and actually having South Korean scientists did the injections at the meridian, at the acupuncture points with actual radiocarbon material, that when they MRI'd it and looked at it, they're like, wow, there's a subvascular system that actually goes through. What they were able to conclude was not only is the actual acupuncture lines, capillaries, the actual system is an actual enclosed system, but it appears to be there as a template for the vascular systems that we know of to build on, as if like the Carilion photography in the early vibrational medicine and Burr's work in the 1940s to show that unfertilized eggs and seeds show a completed template in the magnetic field energy, that the fully grown plant from the seed, that the fully grown human, or like the leaf experiment where you cut a third of the leaf off and it's still there in the holographic imaging, that is actually part, that this meridian system is there prior to the growth of the vascular and nervous of all. It's like it's part of this holographic
even the
image
of
what
phantom
it should be.
Limbs with human
yes,
beings.
Exactly that.
Where somebody gets a donor part and starts adopting characteristics of the person that they got the donation from. Or the same thing with, you know, feeling limbs that were previously there that have been severed and are now mechanical.
Yeah, and I recently have been trying to bring some more attention to this. An orthopedic surgeon in New York was the first to experiment with doing salamanders can regrow limbs. And then frogs have, in quotes, evolutionarily developed to not. And side note for everyone, yeah. The estimate is 2,500 to 4,000 or 5,000 species of things are found every year. Every year. Now, a lot of them are bacteria and fungus, but we find a lot of things. So for the world, you think for you folks out there who think only 500 million people and 5,000 woolly mammoths and 50 billion mosquitoes should be here, you need to keep looking at what's still alive on the planet. But when it comes back to frogs, frogs are not able to regrow limbs. So one of the things that they did was they were removing salamander limbs. And measuring and equating there was a negative charge to the cells. There was a particular frequency. There was a particular magnetic current and a magnetic signature to the limb that was regrowing on the salamander. Well, they mimicked that in the frog, and voila, the frog regrew its limb as it re-remembered once it had the correct negative current. And therein lies the issue. Like, there are sharks that live in the Baltic that are over 400 years old. There are trees that – the question isn't whether or not cells can be repaired. But what I was getting to is that on the cellular level, what they were able to determine – and here's a word for all you sci-fi slash robot-loving people – is that they described electronic cellular switching was going on in the repair area, and they noted it in severe fractures, and they noticed that they could create a current, which first were internally planted on experimental animals, and then later they found just placing a particular current on the surface of a broken bone cast system and running a particular current during night was allowing what should have been limb severing, you know, amputation breaks to return to almost fully normal, complete regrowth by applying currents.
Wow.
And this is technology that's being used in modern medicine now. And so why now?
This is how you end up with the lizard from Spider-Man, yo. Like,
or the Slea Stacks or V or like, you know, see, there's something bad that can come from anything good that we're talking about.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's some really wild stuff out there that, like, I mean, literally, that's half the reason I do this show, is the fact that this stuff is out there in the news. Like, I am actively highlighting stuff from the AllenInstitute.org talking about baby frogs use electricity to signal injury at faraway sites in their body. You know, just wild things like that, that are talking about what you're talking about, you know, cellular regeneration, things like that.
It's a big global, there's a big umbrella here that we're under.
Yeah. And to know that we are on the precipice of that. We are on the precipice of these things that we have known as science fiction for years and years. I mean, it was Arthur C. Clarke that years ago said that what was once magic is actually just science.
Yes.
You know, and it eventually becomes that way. And to know that what we have seen as ancient wild technology that put things together is nothing more than applied science, is nothing more than applied material sciences. Is pretty revolutionary to even think about. And quite honestly, could upset a couple of communities. you know?
And yep.
We talk about that regularly topic on this show about just, A, the cult of personality that exists with such things. And trying to get this information and even the thought form out there.
Yes. And these platforms, you know, us talking and collectively, this is everyone's history, but it's also everyone has a play in it. Everyone has genetic memory. Everyone has an idea, and they might call it spiritual. They might call it paranormal. They might not be sure, but this is everyone's game. You could be no expert, but see a photo that might remind you of something that you may have think was in your history, but it could be collective. It could be a collective consciousness. It could be a download, some kind of memory. So whether you are casually listening, observing, self-experimenting, this is everyone's ball game.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. It is. It's not something that is happening in a vacuum, as a lot of research does. It is something that I think really does take the collective consciousness of humanity to examine. And when you start looking at such things, when you start considering such things, it really is that overarching concept of consciousness, that considering yourself as just a smaller part of something greater.
Yes.
That I think kind of puts us in that same perspective as the person that would spend 30 years of a 45-year lifespan crafting a crystal skull, or, you know, 35 years out of a 50-year lifespan in the Andes building huge walls made out of geopolymers, which, my God, man, we got to have you on to do a whole geopolymer episode, because quite honestly, the whole concept of this to begin with is just mind-numbing. And the idea that, yeah, these people were quite honestly using a technology that to a lot of ancient civilizations was not that foreign, you know?
When it comes to pouring
something into a form.
No, and it's the idea that any group of tribal, any traders, they could mimic what they're seeing. You know, they may not understand the technology, but they, you got sand, you got mud, we got clay.
Yeah.
They would experiment.
Yeah,
at least for primitive cultures, not the originals, but it would be hard not to notice. It does appear that there is many adaptations of primitive pyramids, primitive buildings. The readaptation. And here's a mind blowing sidestep, I guess, as far as, like you said, we can do a different show on it. But the Egyptians were so few in number that they abandoned. They come in on abandoned pre-dynastic Egypt, and there is just megaliths everywhere, and they start readapting and rebuilding, but they don't end up using all of it. They don't get to all of it. I don't think they did. Yeah. I think that when they say, and also for people listening, I'd always heard the stat, you know, 95% of Egypt is still left to be found, and it's all underground. What they don't tell people is that those underground areas are actually rock cut and underground passages. They're not just little tunnels. They're massive, like the Osirion, the Serapeum.
And once you start really getting into things, and we should really do a whole episode about stuff like that, because once you start getting into it, like it's a world of different. The world of actual Egyptology and what's there, and the construction of what went on.
It
really is just it's a world of different, in the way it was done.
Yeah, so it's worth we'll just have to talk it out, separate those, and put them in different episodes.
Oh, most definitely. Number one, I want to thank you for staying slightly past time for a first time guest. Just a little bit over
thank
time.
You.
Not many guests are into that kind of long conversation. I am all about it. Heck, our 300th episode was 7.5 hours.
Wow. That's awesome.
It was epic. We had all kinds of guests on it. It was great. So, I want to welcome you back for more episodes. I definitely want to have you on.
I appreciate it.
To talk about this, to talk about other topics, to talk about all kinds of things. But before we go, it is time for shameless self-promotion on Dudes and Beer, Jared. Tell everybody where they can go other than the Dudes and Beer store online.
Oh, yeah.
To get That's their important. Copy of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History, and more.
There, and I'm not saying no to that. We have a... we have a virtual. I am the keynote virtual conference speaker on Friday, this Friday, for the Forbidden Knowledge News Network.
Ooh,
that
awesome.
Will be on that. Yeah, that'll be on Rockfin, and I will be the keynote on. And I'll have a visual. That actually would be worth doing. That'll be Friday, and I'm the keynote that evening. And then Jim Willis, 13-time author, and it pretty much covers between you and I and everything we just talked about.
Yeah.
He's quite brilliant. And he and I are having a conference on Saturday. Part of the virtual, part of the ticket would include us discussing tabling a number of issues and interacting with the audience. That'll be on Saturday. But then I will be at America's Stonehenge, and you can buy tickets for that. It's not listed, but I promise you it'll be there. As the recording's here for everyone to take, not just take my word for it. But I will be at America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire, May 1st, giving an actual live lecture. I know a lot of people want to get out and actually do something. And America's Stonehenge is open. It is a 105-acre Yep. outdoor site that has, and I'm sure if you've talked about it, people know that there's indications of it being at least 8,000 years old. It's probably much older.
We have featured the owner of America's Stonehenge
Dennis.
Here on the show, and Dennis is an absolutely amazing individual. I cannot wait until the next time that I am up in the area so that I can come up there and visit him. Like I told him, I want to be there for the next major alignment and do a live episode. That is one of the most amazing structures in North America.
It is. It's so, and there's over 800 like it from there all the way to Canada. That area has over 800 similar constructions of that personality, and it has megalithic blocks in it. It appears to be something that was adapted to be what it is for, again, a dynastic people, an indigenous. Well, a more primitive people dragged and used. But the site's been an active archaeological site for 70 years. My lecture is not just a general lecture. It's about, everything we've been talking about, but in details in a way with photographs that I haven't done before. And it'll be for 3 hours, and then there'll be a meet and greet if you want me to sign a book, or you can join virtually. And right now, those tickets are for sale, but they include 6 months of membership on my site on notaliens.com. And if I had a preference for anything right now, I will actually be making available tomorrow tickets that do not include the membership that are just for the show. They'll be around, I think they're going to be around $12, $10, $12.
Oh, wow.
And that would be another way to participate. I would lean on the 29 because it's also going to be, once I do the lecture, which should be fun, and you could watch it live virtually, but we're walking the site, of course, and Dennis Stone invited myself and Michael from Conflict Radio, where I co-host, outside of Not Aliens. So we're there because there's a moon event that we're going there for, that Dennis has invited us to see. And then Saturday we'll walk the site with everybody after, you know, we break from the lecture to do the site tour, which should be super fun because we'll continue beyond the meet and greet and book signing if that's the direction it goes. But really, I would love to see people there or see you there virtually. That's the big thing, is to get people in doing something that doesn't involve not going out. But I know travel's still difficult for a lot of people, and it is a huge trip, and it's really just a one-day event. It's not like it's a big conference, but that's really what's up, that's going on right now, that I'm happy to have talked about in our first awesome fun interview, if we can even call it that. I think this was a great study hall for everyone who's interested.
Well, and that's just it. Like, interviews are one thing. Like I told you in pre-show, I try to just have conversations. I try to just have open-ended conversations with people where, we talk about evidence. We show evidence, you know, even to show the fact of, you know, the wild things going on at America's Stonehenge. Like, Dennis Stone was such an amazing guest, and I cannot wait until the day. I lived in Maine for many, many years, and it was right down the road from me, and I never got to make it. And now my wife's family is from right down the road, and it's one of those, like, oh, believe me, Dennis, I will make it. like, it will happen. It is only a matter of time. So the fact that folks like you are going out there and giving these presentations, talking about this stuff, bringing to light the fact that, once again, like guests like Dennis Stone have said, like guests like Seth Meyers have said, or Stephen Meyers, to go through and say that we have to have some extraneous source of this information. I really don't think so. I think that we can have some incredible, brilliant minds back in the day that found a way to engineer these things and do them. And it was a repetitive technology, and it was not that hard to, you know, much like now, teaching any Boy Scout that moss grows on a certain side of trees, you know, like, this is how you find north when you're out in the wild. Like, it's not rocket math. You like, you could use a compass and that's cool, but without that, this is how people have done it for, oh, I don't know, a few thousand years, and it seems to work. So, yeah, it doesn't take some high technology. It doesn't necessarily take an alien technology for something to be the birth of what we know today, or even what we know as, quote, a mystery today. And I want to thank you all for coming on and talking about that and for bringing that to light, because I think it's very important for us. We are right now in what I've described as just this 100-year cycle period of things happening the world over. We are going through the same economy that we were going through 100 years ago. We are going through the same kind of plague globally that we were going through 100 years ago. We are going through the same kind of rebirth of spiritualism that we were going through 100 years ago. We are going through this rebirth of the concept of electricity and the way that we interact in the world around us that we were doing 100 years ago, with people like Nikola Tesla, stuff like that. So it's really interesting to see where we will go, where we will, to bring it back to the beginning of the episode, quote, wash, rinse, repeat. The technological and social achievements and failures of humanity.
Yeah, this is, it's quite a renaissance that we're living in. Yeah. It really should be. People need to get their head around. This is really exciting. Well, what's going on? It's
I point out all the time that we live in a haze of news. And it's odd that you hear things like CERN announcing in August of this last year that they turned light into matter. Like, let your head wrap around that. They turned light into matter.
Well, so in the world of vibrational medicine, if you really look at it, if we're not a cult of bumping particles, like Ken Wheeler likes to say, if we are actually just energy, vibrational, and of course, you know, frequency and energy in matter terms, I think the best thing I've ever heard is we are frozen light.
Yes. Yeah. I was just explaining, and I mean, I don't even want to go further, dude, because it would just like the rabbit hole only gets wider and deeper from there. When you start talking simulation and you start talking, you know, just because it's a simulation doesn't mean somebody's in charge. That could mean that there's random AIs going on and that's what we are. And like, there's just a whole world of rabbit hole digging that can be done from that point in and of itself. So I want to thank you for coming on. Before we let you go, Jared, it is time for shameless self-promotion. So once again, tell people where they can go to find your stuff, aside from the Dudes and Beer store online.
Yeah. So that's notaliens.com, and that will have my show schedule and of course membership area, and of course the dates for the May America's Stonehenge, where I'll be there in the virtual. I will be on the Forbidden Knowledge News Conference, so that you have to look for, and I have a link to that on my site. And then of course, you know, the book's available on Amazon, and again, you can also get a signed copy from me. And really right now, I'm encouraging people to go for that America's Stonehenge virtual edition. You know, get in. I have a lot of interviews and exclusive content in my member area. It's pretty much the cost of an espresso daily. It's like $265. And if you include the virtual conference, it's basically free. But it's a lot of good stuff, a lot of private photos, Serapium, the stuff that we just talked about, a number of stuff. Jennifer Deo, the archaeologist, I have photos from Egypt galore that are all personal. My research from South Africa, from my time investigating stone circles. I'm constantly doing new interviews and product. That's all out on notaliens.com. So I really loved our time together. I really appreciate you letting me gratuitously push this.
Man, I can't thank you enough for an incredibly succinct episode on.
I appreciate it. You have to half thank Mark Eddy for this, right?
Hey, man, I thank that guy all the time. I say all the time, he is like an angel that just drops down from heaven and hooks people up together. But please do hold the line while we close things out. I would love to chat with you real quick off air. While you're online, everybody, checking out the great work of our guest, Jared Murphy, as well as his website, nightaliens.com. Make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer website. That's where you can find the Dudes and Beer store. That's where you can find the Dudes and Beer everything, the Dudes and Beer app, the Dudes and Beer knowledge vault. If you're into declassified documents, stuff like that, that is where it's at, folks. Go on by and check that out, dudesandbeer.com. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and if you can't be good, be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit HC Universal.